think I'd like to read a couple things, and then I'd like to read three things, and we'll do Q&A. Part of the problem really is identification. That's a really central part. With what or whom do you identify? The mother mouse identified with herself and her those she loved. And it's kind of like the other day, somebody said to me, "So how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq?" And I said, "I didn't know we were in Iraq. I thought we were in Northern California." And the friend said, "It's like, Derek, do I have to put up with this shit all the time?" You know what I meant? How much longer do you think our soldiers are going to be in Iraq? And I said, "They're not my soldiers." There's this great bumper sticker I saw, U.S. out of North America. I really like that. So it's like, with whom do you identify? The attorney at that dinner was saying, you know, if we can take over the White House, she's identifying with the Democrats. Once again, with whom or what do you identify? Do you identify with your own body? Do you identify with your land base? Do you identify, you know, what are the things that are worth living for? What are the things that are worth dying for? What are the things that are worth fighting for? What are the things with whom and with what you identify? Anyway, so here's a little story about that. I go to the post office. Jim, my favorite clerk there, with whom I often chat as he processes the packages I'm mailing, comments on the heat. It's 85 or 86. He says, the second or third highest temperature on record here. I live in cool Northern California. It makes you think about global warming, he says. I nod, then reply, 19,000 people dead in Europe from the heat. The damn newspapers don't even mention global warming. I don't mention that this is more than six times the number killed in the attacks on the World Trade Center. Jim likes my politics, but polite discourse generally demands we ignore many obvious things. Now it's his turn to nod. He says, did you see those pictures of glaciers melting in Europe? The climate's changing, I say, and those in power won't do anything about it. The culture has too much momentum, he responds, and those in charge have too much money and power for us to stop them. That's why, I say, my next book is about how to take down civilization. He looks at me for a moment. You can write a book about it, but you can't make it happen. I can help push in the right direction at the right times. I think that can make a difference. It'll come down all right, he says, and that pretty soon, but it won't be your doing. It'll be the system collapsing in on itself. This is a guy at the post office. There are many who know this, but few who speak it out loud. I say, we can hurry it up. It's going to be nasty, he responds. It already is nasty, I say. That nastiness is exactly why I bought a gun, he said, a .38. I'm about to say that's also exactly why I bought a gun a few years ago, but he carries my packages in the big bins and back. When he returns, he says, it's for myself. I don't know what he means. He says, I don't want to live like that. I say, I don't want to live like this. He says, I don't want to live like an animal. I say, I got news for you, Jim. You already are an animal. He says, I need my electricity. I can't live without it. I don't say anything. I think, is it worth it to you? He looks me straight in the eyes and says, I'm going to retire in January. Don't do this right now. Give me a couple years to enjoy my retirement. Okay, two more things to read. I want to say a couple more things first. One of them is that the most common words I ever hear spoken by an environmentalist anywhere were we're so fucked. So several years ago, I got a call from a friend of mine one night saying, she's a longtime environmentalist, saying, this work is just killing me. It's so hard. It's really painful. I said, yeah, I know it is. Then she said, unless it stops, the dominant culture is going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is. She said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. She said, it hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. And then she said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And I thought a moment, and then I said the thing I knew was best to say all along, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I said that to her is because about 10 years ago, I was undergoing a similar collapse where I was just bursting into sobs several times a week. And, you know, I'd cry over the salmon, the grizzlies, so much. And a lot of my environmentalist friends were saying, you know, Derek, just back off because the problems will be there when you come back. And I knew I couldn't do that. I knew if tears are going to mean anything, I mean, if you're not going to cry over the death of the salmon, what are you going to cry about? And so one day I called this friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, who's an Okanagan Indian writer, activist, and I said, this work's really hard. It's really painful. It's killing me. And she said, yeah, I know it does that. And I said, we're not going to make it to some No, I didn't say that first. I said, unless it's stopped, the dominant culture is going to kill everything, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is. And I said, it has death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. And I said, it hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. And I said, we're not going to make some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could say is because it normalized my despair. It let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. And it let me know that I could feel the pain and the sorrow, and it's just pain and sorrow. You know, it's just pain, it's just sorrow. And it's not so much the pain and sorrow that hurts as it is my resistance to it. And it let me know that I could feel all of those things and it wouldn't kill me. Or even better, that it would kill me. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. You can still sing, and you can still dance, and you can still make love, and you can still fight like hell, but they can't touch you. The logic of the Nazis doesn't work on you anymore. And a question I get sometimes is, if things are so bad, why don't you just kill yourself? And the answer is that life is really, really good. I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we're really fucked and that life's really, really good. And there's a strange notion that if you understand how bad things are, that you have to go around being miserable all the time. But I'm actually really happy. And I'm really sad. I'm really full of rage. I'm full of joy. I'm full of a lot of things. I mean, it's like this person sent me an email a while back saying she wanted to know how my anger at the dominant culture affects my sex life. And I was really tempted to write back. You know, that's a question to which she will never know the answer. And what I was, I mean, but I really thought about it, and it was, it's based on the idea that if you're angry, that your anger has to be a shotgun. But surprisingly enough, you know, if some specific person makes me angry, I can be angry at them. And if some specific thing makes me angry, I can be angry at it. That doesn't mean I have to be angry at you. I may be, goddammit. That we can separate. And the other question that I get a lot is, if things are so bad, why don't you just party? And the answer is, I don't really like parties. I'm actually having a wonderful time. There's this great Irish proverb, is this a private fight or can anybody enter? And that question about if things are so bad, why don't you just party, used to bother me a lot until I realized that the question, the premise is, there we go again, that a premise of that question is that it really reveals nothing more nor less than an incapacity to love. Because if you love, you do what's appropriate to defend your beloved. And of course results matter to you, but they don't matter to whether you make the effort. I got this email from this guy not very long ago saying that his son is 15 years old and he's wonderfully active working for social justice and ecological sanity and all those groovy things. And the problem is that he didn't know how to give his son hope, and he wanted his son to stay active. And I said, if you want your son to stay active, don't give him hope, give him love, and he'll stay active. Because hope, once again, is the whole powerless thing. So the other thing I want to read, there was a point to that story, I just don't remember what it was. I want to read this short, I'm not going to read this whole thing, but there's a couple lines here I really like. A wonderful thing happens when you give up on hope, which is that you realize you never needed it in the first place, kind of like a belief in a Christian heaven. You realize that giving up on hope didn't kill you nor even make you less effective. In fact, it made you more effective because you ceased relying on someone or something else to solve your problems. You ceased hoping your problems would somehow get solved through the magical assistance of God, the Great Mother, the Sierra Club, valiant tree sitters, brave salmon, or even the earth itself. And you just began doing what's necessary to solve the problems yourself. Okay, so that said, I have a confession to make, which is that I've been holding out on you. Quite a while ago, I had one of the most positive conversations I've ever had. Makes me think it really could be possible to speed up the process of bringing down civilization. I talked with some hackers. I hope you'll forgive me if I don't tell you when or where we met or the oddly satisfying circumstances under which we met. I also won't say their names or genders, nor will I describe them. Presume they're men. Presume one of them looks like your bench partner from your high school advanced laboratory class. And the other looks strangely familiar too, like someone you saw once in the far corner of a library surrounded by books on Nestor Makhno, Emiliano Zapata, August Spies, and Albert Parsons. Or maybe it looks like someone you saw standing at the very back of an auditorium as you listened to someone speak passionately about the necessity of taking down civilization now. In any case, here I am, sitting across the table, at least you can presume I'm sitting across the table, from these folks sharing a pitcher of water at a cafe. Let's presume we're in Asheville, North Carolina. It's late, very late on a hot summer night. Let's start small, I say. Would it be possible to inflict serious economic damage on a major corporation by hacking into computer systems? You're presuming, responds the first one, let's call him Brian, that this doesn't happen already. The other, let's call him Dean, nods. I look back and forth between the two. Brian continues, it's in the corporation's best interest not let on that this stuff happens all the time. Why is that, I ask. You think they want people to know how easy it is to hack into a system? He winks, then pauses for effect. It's getting easier all the time. Take the use of wireless technologies that have come on strong these past few years. See that thermostat over there? He points to the far side of the room. Those are oftentimes computerized and send and receive signals through the air from a main system. The other day I hacked into the main computer of a major corporation through the thermostat. My jaw drops. He throws back his head and laughs and says, I didn't do anything. I was just trying to see if I could do it. But could you have done damage? Oh, yeah. How? Name a nasty corporation, he says. Ha, says Dean. Name one that isn't. Freeport McMoRan is pretty nasty. They both shake their heads. Most polluting company in the United States, pollutes all over the world, machine guns natives in Erie and Jaya, imprisons others in shipping crates. Dean looks at me intently before asking, how does it make its money? Mainly mining. Gold in Indonesia, sulfur in the Gulf of Mexico, other minerals too. Okay, Dean says, piece of cake. What do? I ask. Mess with their bank accounts, pretend it's Fight Club and destroy their credit card accounts? Brian wrinkles his nose. Dean says, shipping. All the shipping these days is computerized. Brian interrupts to ask, did you know the U.S. economy almost ground to a halt last year? What? I exclaim. The dock workers strike on the West Coast, Dean says. The big companies couldn't get their raw materials and parts. They were within a day or two of running out. Do you know what happens then? It's clear the question's rhetorical. He asks another question. Do you know how much it would cost GM to shut down its assembly line? I have no idea. Millions of dollars per minute. Jesus, I say. No, Brian responds, dock workers. Or, Dean says, hackers. Let's say Freeport McMoRan ships through Singapore. Singapore is the most automated port in the world. What happens if you reroute canister after canister headed for New Orleans, instead to Honduras, Belize, Istanbul? The people who work for these companies, Brian adds, rely more on computers than common sense. They have to. The companies are so big, the movements of people and resources so complicated, that people can't keep track of it all. Last month, I hacked into the security system of a major corporation and had the computer issue me an ID card. I went to the company headquarters, swiped the card, and it okayed me to enter. I walked over to security people and told them I was a hacker who just breached their security. They refused to believe me. They said the computer okayed me, so I should just quit joking and head on in. I tried to persuade them, but nothing I said convinced them to listen to me. Do you think, I asked, that hackers could do more than just mess with a big corporation or two? Brian smiles. You're presuming again that nobody's already doing this. No, I say. Do you think they could bring it all down, could take down civilization? Brian nods, and so does Dean. Dean says, I've spent the past 20 years studying how the economic system works. I don't mean economic theory, although I certainly understand that, but rather the nuts and bolts of it, transport of raw materials like we were talking about with those canisters. And the thing that amazes me is that the system hasn't already collapsed. It's incredibly fragile, incredibly vulnerable. As Dean talks, Brian pulls what looks like a walkie-talkie from a holster on his belt. The walkie-talkie has a small LED. Suddenly the machine squawks and the light turns green. Guess what, Brian says, somebody in Asheville is receiving a page. He pulls a hand calculator from another holster and punches a few buttons. He shows me the screen. I read information about the page. He smiles proudly, then says, I made a few minor modifications. Ask, why do you do this? It makes me giddy to figure things out. I love the rush when I suddenly understand something new. I know the feeling. I feel what I'd imagine is the same rush whenever I suddenly get the relationship, for example, between pornography and science. I ask, if you love computers, would you take it down? Dean says, yes. Brian says, in a heartbeat. Why? Do you know where they put computer books in bookstores, Brian asks? In the business section. And? Computers were supposed to set us free. That was the rhetoric. That's always the rhetoric. But they've just been used to further enslave us, to further enslave the poor, to further enslave the planet. I become aware of the silence in the room. I take a sip of water. Brian continues, let's say you have a soldering iron that you love to use. You love soldering pieces of metal together. You love burning beautiful designs into pieces of wood furniture. Now, what would you do if somebody started using that soldering iron to torture people? I can't speak for you or anybody else, but I would pull the plug on the iron. I'd do that, he repeats, in a heartbeat. A soft sound breaks the silence of the cafe. Across the room, the lone employee has begun stacking chairs on tables. Brian says, I'm in love with figuring out how things work. And the existence or non-existence of machines doesn't mean we can't figure things out. If I smash this calculator, that doesn't invalidate Ohm's law. Ohm's law is still there. Nature is still there under all the concrete, under all these machines. And if you've gone outside during a blackout, the lights are still there, but they're up in the sky. And it's so quiet, you can finally start to hear. I ask again, and you'd be willing to help bring it down? The woman is stacking chairs close, so we don't have much time. They both laugh and say, of course. You've thought about this a lot. Again, both laugh and say, of course. I have to know. If they were dedicated enough and knew what they were doing, how many people do you think it would take to bring it all down? Brian says, it would take far fewer than Jesus had apostles. The woman has stacked all the chairs but ours. Dean says, let's go. I nod and say, it's late. It is, what? Okay, there's one more thing I want to say. And then we'll do like 30 seconds of Q&A. I'll ask one question, and I'll ask it myself and answer it myself. There we go. Okay, so there's one more thing I do want to talk about, which is there was a woman who came to one of my talks in Eugene, actually came to two of my talks on the same day, because in both of them she wanted to accuse me of being a combination of Mao and Stalin. Because bringing down civilization is all nice and theoretical, but the truth is there will someday be a lot fewer people on the planet than there are now. And so she was basically accusing me of wanting to commit mass murder by wanting to bring down civilization. And the first thing I said is, of course, the people of... I was talking to Anuradha Mittal a few years ago, and I said, would the people of India be better off if the U.S. economy disappeared tomorrow? She said, of course they would. And the example she gave, and this has to do with Europe, but it's the same deal. There are former granaries of India that are now exporting dog food and tulips to Europe, and there are people in India starving to death because of that. So that's one thing. And another thing is that the idea of bringing down civilization is not a monolithic act. I mean, I don't care if you are an anarcho-primitivist or a U.S. soldier, blowing up a children's hospital is an atrocity. It doesn't matter who you are and or what your motivation is. And at the same time, I think it's really hard to make a moral case against taking out cell phone towers. Cell phone towers kill between 5 and 50 million migratory songbirds a year. And I mean, sure, we can make up a case. So we got this woman driving along late at night, and her car dies out on this lonely country road. And so she dials 911. The cops say she's going to come and help her start a car. And she turns on the radio, and she hears that this homicidal maniac just escaped from a prison. He's got a hook on his arm. And then the cop comes, and he starts the car. And she drives away, and the next morning when she goes out and looks at her car, there's this bloody hook hanging from the arm, you know, just like, whew. So, cell phone should stay up. But on the other hand, you got this story, you got this woman driving down the road late at night, she calls her mom, and her mother's this elderly woman who falls down the stairs and breaks her leg, and then grabs the phone and says, please call 911, I'm lying on the floor in tremendous pain. Fortunately, the woman has two cell phones, so she dials 911 with the other cell phone, but then she's, of course, driving with no hands, and she veers off the road, she hits three orphans, and then runs into a tree, and the last thing she sees before she passes out is this hook gleaming in the moonlight. The point being that, you know, you can make up hypotheticals for, you know, to make yourself do or not do any action. But there are some actions that it'd be really hard to make a moral case against. That said, I still couldn't proceed with the book because humans are over-carrying capacity. The primary problem isn't population anyway. The primary problem is a worldview based on refusal to acknowledge limits. But the secondary problem is consumption, and the tertiary problem is population. But in any case, there'll be less people. So what are we going to do about that? What does that mean? I couldn't finish the book until I had... It's like, I don't want to gloss over it. That's a huge, huge thing. How are we going to get there? And I finally came up with an answer that really works for me. If you've got, and the point really also is, if you're civilized, your hands are bloody. So there's no way we can step away. I mean, you can't just sit here. I got a call a couple years ago from this woman at WGBH, a producer for the public radio or public TV show there. She said she was going to do a program on Kaczynski, but she wanted to make sure that she didn't glorify a killer. And I said, that's so good. I'm so glad you're not going to glorify a killer. And I hope that if you did a biography of George Bush or Bill Clinton or Al Gore, you would hold them to the same standards. And she said, I have no idea what you're talking about, which, of course, is why she's a producer for WGBH. And then I said, you know, look, do you pay taxes? She said, yes. And I said, well, in that case, you've killed way more people than Ted Kaczynski because, of course, you support the U.S. military. And oddly enough, I didn't end up in a documentary. Anyway, so the point is, we're all inculpated, which we could talk about if we had more time. Anyway, if you've gotten this far in the book, we probably agree that civilization's going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't believe that, we probably have nothing to say to each other. How about them cubbies? We probably also agree the crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner it comes down, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. So these are the premises. If you agree civilization is not going to last, if you agree the crash is going to be messy, and if you agree that the longer we wait, the worse it's going to be, because if you agree with all those, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring it down, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, that civilization is going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan and they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or, if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people... Thank you. We need people... You can clap about it, but you can't do it. We need people to... That was a joke, Mr. Ashcroft. We need people to protest and chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All this can look like supporting traditional local knowledge. It can look like starting rooftop gardens. It can look like planting local varieties of medicinal herbs. And it can look like teaching people how to sing.
Yes!
The truth is that although I don't believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do have a responsibility to support the people doing that work. Similarly, people growing medicinal plants do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who've chosen that work. In fact, they have a responsibility to support them. They especially have a responsibility to not report them to the cops. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so fucked up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love, do what you can, do what best serves your land base. We need it all. This doesn't mean that everyone taking out dams and everyone working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goals. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large-scale and coordinated. The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places, simultaneously if possible. By contrast, the work of renewal must be local. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they'll thrive. I have a new catchphrase: dismantle globally, renew locally. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. This doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas or that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what'll work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. I've been thinking a lot again about the cell phone tower behind Safeway, and I see now how these different approaches manifest in this one small place. The cell phone tower needs to come down. It is contiguous on two sides with abandoned parking lots. Those lots need to come up. Gardens can bloom in their place. We can even do our work side by side. So, thank you.
You've been listening to Derek Jensen speaking last February at the 3rd Annual Sustainable Living Conference in Olympia, Washington. He is the author of many books, including The Culture of Make-Believe, A Language Older Than Words, Listening to the Land, and the soon-to-be-completed Bringing Down Civilization. He has a website, DerekJensen.org, spelled DerekJensen.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This week, we'll conclude our reading of the book Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. We've been reading weekly installments from Disciplined Minds since last October. Last week, I began Chapter 16, the book's final chapter, entitled Now or Never. In this chapter, the author deals with practical strategies for radical professionals working in mainstream jobs, how to maintain one's values and how to work from within the system to agitate and advocate for one's values. Where I left off last week, I was going through a list of 33 different actions suggested by the author. And this week, I'll pick up with number 14, which is, conspire with radicals in your workplace and in other workplaces to tilt your professional work and theirs to the left, so that it favors as much as possible those with less wealth and power. Also, you recommend knowledgeable radicals for non-radicals to consult in carrying out their assignments. Number 15. Help coworkers understand that their conflicts with local authority, their department or division managers, have more to do with the actual social function of the institution as a whole than with the personalities of the managers. When managers are not around and coworkers get together and talk informally, the most common topics are office politics, rumors, gossip, and personalities, all of which tend to focus on power in the workplace. Office politics addresses the subject directly. Rumors often concern what those in power are planning to do. Gossip mainly has to do with the things coworkers may be doing to escape their quote-unquote place. And when personalities are the topic, the bosses get much more than their fair share of attention, as their personalities are analyzed and reanalyzed ad infinitum. You participate in these discussions, understanding that those with little power and information must, for their own protection, monitor every move of those who have more power and information. But as a radical, you also try to broaden the discussion to deal with the systemic origins of the conflicts, why they persist, even as various management personalities come and go. You help coworkers understand how many of their grievances have their origin in the workplace hierarchy and the assigned ideology that goes along with it, the very ideology that guides their work. You explain how the workplace hierarchy goes hand in hand with the assigned ideology, so that the struggle against one must involve a struggle against the other. As a workplace radical, you are more than someone who favors militancy in the fight for your coworkers' economic demands. You draw a connection so as to spread understanding of how the system works and why it must be changed. Number 16. Help coworkers and others to acknowledge the forbidden and difficult to accept truth pointed to by their own conflicts and frustrations. Hierarchical organizations are fundamentally flawed. This acknowledgement will in turn stimulate them to develop their own vision of how the workplace should be organized, making them harder to manage and ultimately forcing the management to make democratic concessions. Most situations that cause employees' anxiety and stress would be only minor problems if the individuals involved had equal shares of power. Thus, to those who have experienced conflict, your radical democratic views will at least make sense. You offer these individuals all the hard-won lessons of how structural inequality is bad news. 6 examples. First, hierarchical organizations take the fun out of work. They centralize decision-making so that most people involved in an activity or project are deprived of creative control, alienating them from their own work and killing their enthusiasm. This makes individuals less productive. Ever notice how people work hardest on self-assigned projects and leaves them less fulfilled? Nobody says, "Wow, you work in a hierarchy? That must be fun." Second, hierarchical power structures twist people's personalities. The skills people develop for surviving in hierarchies are different from those they would develop in a democratic setup. As one secretary where I work confided proudly to another, "I know who's asked to kiss around here." Third, hierarchical power structures are necessarily secretive. Executives make key decisions behind closed doors. The hierarchical structure keeps people in the dark, even about issues that affect them directly, and engenders rumors. Fourth, hierarchical power structures create repressive environments. They produce fear and insecurity, killing free expression and spontaneous activity. People huddle and talk in hushed tones. CYA governs their work. Criticisms of the status quo and trial and error are necessary for progress, and so hierarchical power structures slow progress. Fifth, hierarchical power structures stunt personal development. They cause conformist behavior by increasing the personal risk associated with creativity, independent thinking, and dissent. They narrow the scope of each individual's work, ensuring that most people do not experience a wide variety of activity. In these and other ways, hierarchy deprives individuals of the environment of freedom and experimentation necessary for personal growth. Sixth, hierarchical power structures are inherently violent. The few can't maintain their authority over the many through rhetoric alone. Although bosses, for example, rarely use guards or police, their right to do so influences people's behavior, most obviously during individual confrontations and strikes. More importantly, on a daily basis, hierarchies subordinate and humiliate, and, as mentioned, make people's working lives a grind, warp their personalities, perpetuate their ignorance, repress their spontaneity, and stunt their personal development, amounting to a kind of violence against the individual. Some individuals respond with actual violence. Those pushed over the edge tend to go crazy in a particular way, aiming their guns up the hierarchy more often than down. But more commonly, people respond with many nonviolent forms of resistance, or with redirected violence such as alcohol and drug abuse and domestic brutality. All six problems mentioned here, and certainly others, are endemic to hierarchy, and so you can point out that they will eventually arise in every hierarchical system, be it an economic system such as capitalism, which is inherently hierarchical because authority originates in ownership, or a hierarchical workplace, political organizations, social or volunteer organizations, or personal relationship. Any such social grouping can be organized non-hierarchically and is always more human when it is. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. Reading from Chapter 16, the book's final chapter, titled Now or Never. And this is number 17 of the actions radicals can take in the workplace. Write and publish an exposé of the organization that employs you. You can do this as a public service to demystify one of society's institutions and to give insight into the workings of such organizations in general. You detail the way the bosses treat employees and the way they fashion the organization's products or services for clients and the public, showing the objectives that explain both. This look behind the scenes will not only entertain readers and enlighten them about the true nature of the organization, but will also force the bosses to curb some of their excesses. You make this a group effort if you can, and probably published the result under a pseudonym. Number 18. Sharpen and deepen your coworkers' dissatisfaction with the restrictions on their work. If a coworker shows no such dissatisfaction, stir some up. Through its misrepresentation of the nature of the professional, the culture instills in those who aspire to go to professional school expectations of autonomy and of creative and fulfilling work. Professional training itself, however, is a process not of building up such expectations, but of cooling them out. And it usually succeeds in getting individuals to be, quote, realistic, that is, to accept strict limits on their expectations. You encourage any expectations that have survived. You explain that boring or narrow jobs are not natural, but are the result of the way the system divides labor to serve employer interests at the expense of both employees and clients. You support individual professional and non-professional coworkers in their struggles to be allowed to do work that is more interesting, more challenging, more fulfilling, or better for furthering their personal development. But you bring out how such struggles are fights with the system. You encourage coworkers to experiment and innovate in carrying out their work assignments, and you support their struggles to be allowed to exercise initiative, explaining how the restrictions on such activity originate in the hierarchical system rather than in the style or personality of one or another manager. With the same explanation, you fight against dead-end jobs and support people's struggles for work that will further their careers. It is not possible to draw a line that separates political and economic demands. Number 19. Help lay bare the intimate details of management's decision-making about the content of the work. Because workplace secrecy increases the power of the bosses by ensuring that they are the only ones with a comprehensive knowledge of what is going on, you work to spread around as much information as possible. When you know the details of how the bosses made a particular decision, you inform people inside and outside of the organization, and you encourage coworkers to do the same. This helps reveal management's politics and enables people to predict its decisions in the future. Number 20. Encourage openness in personnel matters, specifically in individual terms of employment. Secrecy allows management to avoid the pressure of precedence so that it can give each employee the cheapest deal it can get away with. With openness, all employees would have the precedent of the best deal. Hence, you encourage coworkers to reveal details with management. And yes, you advocate making lists of salaries public. The bosses strongly discourage such openness and are often extremely angry when it occurs. Not because they're out to, quote, protect your privacy, but because they are out to protect themselves from the cost of satisfying employees who have discovered the details of how they are being taken advantage of. Number 21. Encourage openness in personnel matters, specifically in individual disputes with management. When you have a dispute with management, the bosses insist on discussing it with you behind closed doors, not because they want to protect your privacy, but because they want to deny you the support of coworkers. Behind closed doors, you stand alone against the institution. Hence, you try to handle conflict. 3-1. Hence, you try to handle conflicts with the boss in front of coworkers to whatever extent possible. In any case, you recount the details of your disputes to coworkers, and you encourage coworkers to do the same when they have disputes with management. Number 22. Encourage coworkers to use their collective strength to maintain their individual dignity. You encourage employees to take their grievances to management collectively rather than individually. In the typical one-on-one meeting in the manager's office, the boss pretends to treat the employee as an equal, and the employee either plays along with the pretense to avoid humiliation or is disarmed by it out of desperation for an ego boost. In either case, the indignity is there. In a collective meeting, power is more equal. in general, you support non-professionals and other professionals when they go up against the institution alone. Number 23. Fight to get professional organizations to handle grievances. That is, to consider it their business to intervene in personnel matters on behalf of individual members. The availability of such backing would put members in a much better position to challenge their employers on the political content of the work. Number 24. Help organize a union. After all, management is organized and sticks together to defend its interests. Number 25. Undermine management's ability to manipulate employees. You become an expert on management tactics and tricks. You become an expert on the principles of resistance, and you spread this knowledge throughout the workplace. The excerpts in Chapter 15 from the Army Field Manual are a great starting point. That chapter discussed the manual primarily in terms of the training institution, but I'm sure that every reader who has ever worked as a professional immediately recognized the manual's relevance to the workplace as well. Hire coworkers on the basis of character. When there are job openings at the workplace, managers sometimes ask professionals on the staff to meet some of the applicants and comment on them. Typically, the bosses will have already filtered out the ones who don't have the technical ability to do the job. So you need to ask only one question. And if you can talk to the candidates outside the presence of managers, you can ask it directly. What do you stand for? Or perhaps even more to the point, in a world where flexibility has become the key to marketability, do you stand for anything? You are simply trying to find out what the person will fight for, if anything. The managers will be sorting the interviewees by character, too, looking for team players, management's euphemism for people who stand for nothing of their own. Number 27. Fight elitism, authoritarianism, and hierarchy by resisting a professional self-identity. Your academic degree and job title do a lot to shape your workplace identity. But don't let your fancy credentials go to your head and shape your self-identity. Whenever you have a choice in your interactions with coworkers and clients and with people in your life outside the workplace, you downplay your formal education and your position within the system, recognizing that that would be elitist to imply that such credentials make you even a bit more deserving of respect than other people. When you identify yourself, don't adorn your name with titles such as Doctor, PhD, Professor, or Esquire. Because fighting elitism is at the top of your agenda as a radical, you realize that no matter how much farther you might advance your progressive views on one or another issue by flaunting your credentials, such elitist behavior would do even more to set back your ultimate goals. In fact, even if all you care about was prevailing on just one issue at hand, and you didn't care if you promoted elitism in the process, arguing from authority would still be counterproductive. For if your own degree and job title lend validity to your conclusions, then the paper credentials and positions of your establishment-oriented colleagues lend validity to the opposition conclusions. And there are more of them than there are of you. For every radical in your field, there may be dozens of establishment-oriented professionals, many with academic degrees and job titles fancier than yours. And so any implication that a person's formal education or position within the system lends validity to that person's political views does more for the other side than it does for yours. Hence, the use of system-based authority against the system itself, always a temptation for some, is a double loser. As a radical, you realize that the system of authority works against you. Some of the most backward things that you have ever heard have come from well-educated, quote, authorities, and you realize that you therefore have no choice but to work against the system of authority. Take it from me, an authority on expertise. You can't trust experts. Your gut reaction to system-based credentials is more one of suspicion than of respect, because you see their underside. A person's flashy diploma or job title, for example, brings to your mind the degree to which that person has been processed by the system, is trusted by the system, or is concerned about keeping the system's trust. In your own case, you don't worry about being respectable by the system's measure. You give respect and expect to receive it according to your own measure, in which commitment to the opposition counts and success within the system does not. And you are careful not to give the system credit for such commitment. You understand the politics of professional qualification too well to think that the progressive outlook of oppositional professionals is due to the enlightening effect of their extensive formal education. You know that when professionals have good politics, it is not because of their professional training, but in spite of it. Finally, you don't let rank within the system determine rank or authority within the anti-system movement, as often happens in professional associations. Many people check out the opposition because the elitist system turns them into nobodies. Opposition groups that do the same thing by honoring system-based credentials and thereby importing hierarchies from the system should not wonder why few people stick around. People subordinate themselves to authority at work because they are paid to do so. And even then, they resist. Few are about to do so voluntarily. Number 28. Work to democratize your field, to break down the hierarchy within it. You draw attention to the establishment connections of the field's establishment. Number 29. Use your position within the system to help other radicals. Commitment to the opposition usually involves career and financial sacrifices. You help counterbalance these by helping radicals to get jobs, by supplying them with references and recommendations, by giving them access to the resources and products of the organization that employs you, by making available to them free or at cost professional services, and by helping them get anything else you can from the system. When you give someone this kind of help, you don't see yourself as doing the individual a personal favor, but as helping the movement. You expect no return or special thanks, because you see yourself as simply fulfilling the obligation of a radical who has a professional position within the system. You expect to receive such help yourself when you need it, and you recognize the right of radicals to expect it from you. Number 30. Work to abolish professionals. That is, you work to eliminate the professional-nonprofessional division of labor, not only because it stunts the intellectual development of people on both sides of the division, but also because it works against democracy in society. If knowledge is power, then a truly democratic society is impossible without the broad distribution of expertise throughout the population. Thus, you encourage non-professional co-workers, clients, and others to gain some technical understanding and skills of your profession. Many of the most useful skills are simple and can be learned quickly. You take the time to apprentice people to minimize their dependence on professionals. You give away your skills. Number 31. Build solidarity between professionals and non-professionals by encouraging your professional co-workers to see themselves as labor and by discouraging them from seeing themselves as superior to labor. Salaried professionals are workers who have been hired to carry on intellectual labor under the guidance of an assigned ideology. The mental contortions that professionals have to perform to maintain the pretense that they are superior to labor and that they are ideologically self-directed are stifling and unhealthy. Dropping the pretense and acknowledging that you are a rank-and-file member of the ideologically directed intellectual workforce opens the door to many forms of resistance and is personally empowering. The staff professional's universal complaint, "They treat us like wage laborers here," should lead not to demands for special privileges for professionals, but to specific demands for better treatment of all the institution's employees. To strengthen professionals for this struggle, you encourage them to identify not with the institution, but with labor, to see themselves as renting their abilities to the system for a certain number of hours per week, to resist working longer hours than the non-professionals in the organization, and to expect overtime compensation when they do. But most important, to take the attitude that they do not want to serve the assigned ideology a minute longer than they have to. Finally, you avoid subtle put-downs of non-professionals. For example, when you argue that a particular group of professionals deserves higher salaries, you don't use arguments that imply that professionals have some sort of natural or moral right to have a higher standard of living than non-professionals. You argue that the professionals deserve a raise because they are exploited, that is, because the value of their work to the employers is greater than that of their pay, not because plumbers or bus drivers out-earn them. You don't subscribe to the notion that someone who has been privileged enough to spend many years in college and who gets to do work that offers many non-monetary rewards should be naturally rewarded with a salary higher than that of non-professionals. That is, reward privilege is not part of your ideology. Number 32. Undermine management's information advantage. Management's knowledge of what is going on in workplaces throughout the industry, throughout the country, and throughout the world gives it tremendous advantage over labor in its own workplace, allowing it to judge rather precisely just how much it can get away with. Its historical knowledge of struggles with labor allows it to fine-tune this judgment. To cut management's advantage, you arm your co-workers with as much information about the big picture as possible. You simply want your fellow employees to know and use to their advantage what top management already knows and uses to its advantage, that their grievances are not unique, that their own workplace is just one of many battle sites in a widespread contest between labor and management, and that they have much to gain by following the overall struggle. You get a lot of your information by reading the very same publications that your institution's top management reads to get its broad perspective. These almost certainly include the Wall Street Journal, as well as the appropriate trade publications. If the institution deals with academics, for example, the Chronicle of Higher Education would be required reading. The best way to judge a publication, and at the same time determine how useful it might be to you, is to figure out its role in society. The above-mentioned newspapers make good examples. The Wall Street Journal is for decision-makers. Not just those in business, but all decision-makers throughout a society that is dominated by business. Unlike the New York Times and other newspapers for wider audiences, and contrary to popular mythology, the Journal does not push the establishment's side in its reporting. It serves the establishment in a different way by informing its members from an above-the-fray perspective, trusting them to come to their own conclusions. One of its most important functions is to give top managers the comprehensive social intelligence they must have if they are to boss their employees effectively and market to the public successfully. Thus, the Journal keeps its subscribers up to date on contemporary sociology and popular culture, giving the bosses the intimate details of the lives and aspirations of individuals at each and every level of society, from Skid Row on up, while always quickly reporting on anyone who is doing something out of the ordinary. The fact that the Journal does not use photographs, together with a widespread but innocent belief that it contains only boring financial data and articles that praise the system, help keep the wrong eyes from seeing the big picture. The Chronicle of Higher Education is a weekly intelligence report for university bosses, focusing primarily on ideology. It keeps administrators on top of the ideological battles that are going on within each of the many fields of research, and it reports on newly produced ideology the moment it appears in books, journal articles, or talks. It also keeps administrators up to the minute on student culture, reporting in great detail the attitudes and activities of college students across the country and around the world. And of course, it briefs administrators on academic labor disputes. If reading such establishment publications keep you as informed as local management, then adding the opposition press to your reading list propels your awareness beyond that of your bosses, but you don't give them any tips. Number 33. Help liberate non-professionals and professionals themselves from the mystique of the professional. One way that you demystify professionals is by making clear their role in the system of production, whose caste can be analyzed like this. Non-professional employees follow assigned procedures. Professional employees follow assigned ideologies. Employers critically assess ideologies and develop ideologies to assign. And undermining this not-so-happy hierarchy from within, a subgroup of non-professional and professional employees, radicals, critically assess ideologies and develop and propagate democratic ideologies that challenge the employer's elite-serving ideologies. You also explain the politics of professional qualification. The criterion for certification as a professional is not just technical knowledge, but also attitude, specifically an uncritical attitude. You want everyone to understand the politics of professional qualification at least as well as those who hire and fire professionals understand it. Note from the descriptions listed above that the radical, of all people, is on an intellectual par with the employer. Both see the big picture and know the utmost importance of ideology. Only the radical, however, wants to bring other employees up to this higher level of understanding. Explaining the division of labor and the politics of professional qualification is a step in that direction. At stake is not only the nature of the workplace and society, but your own nature as well, your very identity. The system of education and employment works to redefine who you are in the deepest sense, pushing you away from developing and acting upon your own vision and guiding ideas. Hence, if you want to stand for something and avoid vanishing as an independent force in society, you have no choice but to resist. Certainly, resisting the system carries some risk, but not resisting is a far deadlier course for your individual identity. And that was the conclusion of Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives, by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. Jeff, if you're listening, I'd like to personally thank you for writing this book. And I'd like to encourage everyone to read this book and get others to read it. If you'd like to find out more about the book Disciplined Minds or how to obtain it, you can visit on the web www.disciplinedminds.com. And if you'd like to download MP3s of our previous programs that contain readings of Disciplined Minds, or to contact us on the show for any reason, please visit our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.